"Interfering's what we do professionally, I'm afraid," said the sister on his right. "We left the place open just in case you might want to stick your head in. Hoped you wouldn't be able to resist. And we know a thing or two about the lady most kind ourselves, although our service to her is a bit more direct than yours." With that, red light gleamed on naked steel. Each sister had drawn out a curved, arm-length blade, thieves' teeth, just as Maranzala had shown him so many years earlier. The Barangius twins continued their steady approach. "Well," said Jean, "if we're already past the pleasantries, ladies, allow me to quit this masquerade." Jean tossed his light globe on the ground, reached up, pulled back his black hood, and slipped off his mask. "Tannen," said the sister on his right. "Well, holy shit. So you didn't go out through the Viscount's gate after all?" The Barangius sisters halted, staring at him. Then they began circling to his left, moving in graceful unison, giving themselves more space to take action. "You have some cheek," said the other, "impersonating a priest of Azaguia."
"Beg pardon? You were going to kill a priest of Azaguia?"
"Yes, well, you seem to have saved us from that particular blasphemy, haven't you?" "This is convenient," said the other sister. "I never dreamed it'd be this easy."
"Oh, whatever it is," said Jean, "I guarantee it won't be easy."
"Did you like our work in your little glass cellar?" The sister on the left spoke now. "Your two friends, the sons, are twins. Twins done in by twins. Same wounds to the throat, same pose on the floor. Seemed appropriate."
"Appropriate?"
Jean felt new anger building like pressure at the back of his skull. He ground his teeth together.
"Mark my words, bitch. I've been wondering how I'd feel when this moment finally came, and I have to say I think I'm going to feel pretty fucking good."
The Barangius sisters shrugged off their cloaks with nearly identical motions. As the oilcloth fluttered to the floor, they threw down their light globes and drew out their other blades. Two sisters, four knives. They stared intently at Jean in the mingled red and white light and crouched, as they had 100 times before crowds of screaming thousands at the shifting revel, as they had 100 times before pleading victims in Kappa Barsavi's court.
"Wicked sisters," said Jean, as he let the hatchets fall out of his right robe sleeve and into his hand, "I'd like you to meet the wicked sisters."
3.
"But don't take it to amiss, Lucas," said Doña Sofia, as she set her hollowed-out orange back down on her shelf. "We have a few possible remedies."
"We might only be out of the necessary funds for a few days," said Don Lorenzo. "I have other sources I can tap. I do have peers who would be good for the loan of a few thousand. I even have some old favors I can call in."
That is a relief, my lord and lady, quite a relief. I am pleased to hear that your situation need not ruin our plan, and I wouldn't call it embarrassing, not at all. If anyone knows about financial hardship, why, it would be the House of Bel-Oster.
"I shall speak to several of my likely sources of a loan next Idler's Day, which is, of course, the Day of Changes. Have you ever been to any formal celebration of the festival, Lucas?"
"I'm afraid not, Don Lorenzo. I have previously never been in Camor at the midsummer mark."
"Really?"
Doña Sofia raised her eyebrows at her husband.
"Why don't we bring Lucas with us to the Duke's feast?"
"An excellent idea."
Don Lorenzo beamed at Locke.
"Lucas, since we can't leave until I've secured a few thousand more crowns anyway, why not be our guest? Every peer and Camor will be there, every man and woman of importance from the lower city."
"At least," said Doña Sofia, "the ones that currently have the Duke's favor."
"Of course," said Lorenzo, "do come with us. The feast will be held in Raven's Reach. The Duke opens his tower only on this one occasion every year.
My lord and Lady Salvara, this is quite an unexpected honor, but though I fear very much to refuse your hospitality, I also fear that it might possibly interfere with my ongoing work on our behalf.
Oh, come, Lucas, said Lorenzo. It's 4 days hence. You said you'd be supervising loading the first galleon for the next few days. Take a rest from your labors and come enjoy a very singular opportunity. Sophia can show you around while I press some of my peers for the loans I need. With that money in hand, we should be able to set out just a few days after that, correct? Assuming you've told us of every possible complication?
Yes, my Lord Salvara, the matter of the second galleon is the only complication we face other than your, loss of fluidity. And at any rate, even its cargo for Balinel will not be in the city until next week. Fortune and the Marrows may be favoring us once again.
It's settled, then?
Doña Sofia linked hands with her husband and smiled. You'll be our guest at Raven's Reach?
It's accounted something of an honor, confided the Don, to bring an unusual and interesting guest to the Duke's celebration. So we are eager to have you with us for several reasons.
If it would give you pleasure, said Locke. I fear that I am not much for celebrations, but I can set aside my work for a night to attend.
You won't be sorry, Lucas, said Doña Sofia. I'm sure we'll all think back very fondly on the feast when we begin our voyage.
4. In many ways, 2 was the worst possible number of multiple opponents in a close-quarters fight. It was nearly impossible to lead them into crowding and interfering with one another, especially if they were experienced at working together. And if anyone in Camor was any good at fighting in tandem, it was the Barangius sisters. Jean accounted his scant advantages as he twirled his hatchets and waited for one of the sisters to make the first move. He'd seen them in action at least a dozen times, at the shifting revel and in the floating grave. It might not do him much good, since he didn't happen to be a shark, but it was something.
"We've heard that you're supposed to be good," said the sister on his left,
and just as she spoke, the one on the right exploded forward, one knife out in a guard position and the other held low to stab. Jean sidestepped her lunge, blocked the thrusting knife with his left hatchet, and whipped the other one toward her eyes. Her second blade was already there. The hatchet rebounded off the studded handguard. She was as impossibly fast as he'd feared. So be it. He kicked out at her left knee, an easy trick he'd used to break a dozen kneecaps over the years. Somehow, she sensed the blow coming and bent her leg to deflect it. It struck her calf, pushing her off balance but accomplishing little else. Jean disengaged his hatchets to swing at where she should be falling, but she turned her sideways fall into a whirlwind kick. She swiveled on her left hip faster than his eyes could follow, and her right leg whipped around in a blurred arc. That foot cracked against his forehead, right above his eyes, and the whole world shuddered. Chasson, of course, he could really learn to hate the art. He stumbled backward. Drilled instinct alone saved him from her follow-up, a straight thrust that should have punched through his solar plexus and buried her blade to the hilt. He swung his hatchets down and inward, a maneuver Don Maranzala had jokingly referred to as the crab's claws. He hooked her blade with his right-hand hatchet and yanked it sideways. That actually surprised her. Jean took advantage of her split-second hesitation to ram the tip of his other hatchet into the base of her neck. He didn't have time for an actual swing, but he could give a pretty forceful poke. She stumbled back, coughing, and he suddenly had a few feet of space once again. He stepped back another yard. The wall of the warehouse was looming behind him, but at a range of scant inches those knives were greatly superior to his own weapons. He needed reach to swing. The left-hand Barangius dashed forward as the one on the right faded back, and Jean swore under his breath. With his back to the wall, they couldn't try to take him from opposite sides, but he couldn't run, and they could trade off attacks, one falling back to recover while the other sister continued to wear him down.
His temper rose again. Bellowing, he tossed both of his hatchets at his new opponent. That caught her by surprise. She sidestepped with speed that matched her sister, and the weapons whirled past on either side, one of them catching at her hair. But Jean hadn't been in earnest with his gentle throw. He charged at her, hands outstretched. Empty hands would do better against thieves' teeth when opponents were close enough to kiss. The sister before him spread her blades again, confident of a quick kill. Yet it was easy to underestimate Jean's own speed if one hadn't seen it up close before. His hands clamped down on her forearms. Putting his strength and mass to good use, he spread her arms forcefully. As expected, she raised one of her legs to give him a sharp kick. Digging his fingers into the hard muscle of her forearms, keeping her blades firmly to the outside, he yanked as hard as he could. She flew forward, and with a smack that echoed in the warehouse, her nose met Jean's forehead. Hot blood spattered. It was on his robes, but he hoped Azaguia might eventually forgive him that little indignity. Before his opponent could recover, Jean let her arms go, cupped her entire face in one of his hands, and pushed from the hip with all of his might, like a shot putter at the Therin throne games of old. She flew into her sister, who barely got her blades out of the way in time to avoid skewering her sibling, and the Barangius twins toppled against the tarp-covered pile of corpses. Jean ran to the center of the warehouse floor, where his hatchets lay on the dirt. He picked them up, twirled them once, and quickly worked at the little clasp that held his robe together beneath the collar. While the sisters recovered themselves, Jean shrugged out of his robe and let it fall to the ground. The Barangius twins advanced on him again, about 10 feet apart, and now they looked distinctly upset. Gods, Jean thought, most men would take a broken nose as a sign to run like hell, but the sisters continued to bear down on him, malice gleaming in their dark eyes. The eerie red and white light was at their back, and it seemed to outline them in eldritch fire as they spread their blades for another pass at him. At least he had room to maneuver now. Without a word between them, the Barangius sisters took to their heels and rushed at him, four knives gleaming. It was their own professionalism that saved Jean this time. He knew before it happened that one would faint and one would strike home. The sister on his left, the one with a broken nose, attacked a split second before the one on his right. With his left-hand hatchet raised as a guard, he stepped directly into the path of the one on his left. The other sister, eyes wide in surprise, lunged at the space he'd just slipped out of, and Jean swung his right-hand hatchet in a backhand arc, ball first, that caught her directly atop her skull. There was a wet crack, and she hit the floor hard, knives falling from her nerveless fingers. The remaining sister screamed, and Jean's own mistake caught up with him at that moment. A feint can become a killing strike once more with very little effort. Her blade slashed out just as he was raising his right-hand hatchet once again. He caught and deflected one with his raised hatchet, but the other slid agonizingly across his ribs just beneath his right breast, laying open skin and fat and muscle. He gasped, and she kicked him in the stomach, staggering him. He toppled onto his back. She was right on top of him, blood streaming down her face and neck, eyes full of white-hot hate. As she lunged down, he kicked out with both of his legs. The air exploded out of her lungs, and she flew back, but there was a sharp pain in his right biceps, and a line of fire seemed to erupt on his left thigh. Damn, she'd had her blades in him when he pushed her back. She'd slashed open a ragged line along the top of his thigh with his help. He groaned. This had to end quickly, or blood loss would do for him as surely as the blades of the surviving sister. She was back on her feet already. Gods, she was fast. Jean heaved himself up to his knees, feeling a tearing pain across his right ribs. He could feel warm wetness cascading down his stomach and his legs. That wetness was time running out. She was charging at him again. Red light gleamed on steel, and Jean made his last move. His right arm didn't feel strong enough for a proper throw, so he tossed his right-hand hatchet at her, underhand, directly into her face. It didn't have the speed to injure, let alone kill, but she flinched for a second, and that was long enough. Jean whipped his left-hand hatchet sideways and into her right knee. It broke with the most satisfying noise Jean could recall hearing in his life. She staggered, a rapid yank and a backhand whirl, and his blades bit deep into the front of her other knee. Her blades came down at him then, and he threw himself sideways. Steel whistled just past his ears as its wielder toppled forward, unable to bear weight on her legs any longer. She screamed once again. Jean rolled several times to his right, a wise decision. When he stumbled up to his feet, clutching at his right side, he saw the surviving sister dragging herself toward him, one blade still held tightly in her right hand.
"You're bleeding hard, Tannen. You won't live out the night, you fucking bastard!"
"That's gentleman bastard," he said. "And there's a chance I won't. But you know what? Carlo and Galdo Sanza are laughing at you, bitch."
He wound up with his left arm and let his remaining hatchet fly, a true throw this time, with all the strength and hatred he could put behind it. The blade struck home right between the Barangia sister's eyes. With the most incredible expression of surprise on her face, she fell forward and sprawled like a rag doll. Jean wasted no time in reflection. He gathered his hatchets and threw on one of the sister's oil cloaks, putting up the hood. His head was swimming. He recognized all the signs of blood loss, which he'd had the misfortune to experience before. Leaving the bodies of the Barangia sisters in the light of the fallen glow globes, he stumbled back out into the night. He would avoid the cauldron, where some sort of trouble was sure to lurk, and make a straight run across the north of the wooden waste. If he could just make it to the Ashfall hovel, Ibelius would be there, and Ibelius would have some trick up his sleeves. If the dog-leech attempted to use a poultice on him, however, Jean was likely to break his fingers. 5. In her solarium atop Amberglass Tower, Doña Vorcenza spent the midnight hour in her favorite chair, peering at the evening's notes. There were reports of the ongoing strife from the Grey King's ascension to Barsavi's seat. More thieves found lying in abandoned buildings with their throats slashed. Vorcenza shook her head. This mess was really the last thing she needed with the affair of the Thorn finally coming to a head. Raza had identified and exiled half a dozen of her spies among the gangs. That in itself was deeply troubling. None of them had been aware of one another as agents. So either all of her agents were clumsier than she'd suspected, or Raza was fantastically observant. Or there was a breach in her trust at some level above the spies on the street. Damnation. And why had the man exiled them, rather than slaying them outright? Was he trying to avoid antagonizing her? He'd certainly not succeeded. It was time to send him a very clear message of her own, to summon this Kappa Raza to a meeting with Stephen, with 40 or 50 blackjackets to emphasize her points. The elaborate locks to her solarium door clicked, and the door slid open. She hadn't been expecting Stephen to return this evening. What a fortunate coincidence. She could give him her thoughts on the Raza situation. The man that entered her solarium wasn't Stephen Reynard. He was a rugged man, lean-cheeked and dark-eyed. His black hair was slashed with grey at his temples, and he strolled into her most private chamber as though he belonged there. He wore a grey coat, grey breeches, grey hose, and grey shoes. His gloves and vest were grey, and only the silk neckcloths tied casually above his chest had colour. They were blood-red. Doña Vorcenza's heart hammered. She put a hand to her chest and stared in disbelief. Not only had the intruder managed to open the door, and done so without taking a crossbow bolt in the back, but there was another man behind him. A younger man, bright-eyed and balding, dressed in a similar grey fashion, with only the bright scarlet cuffs of his coat to set him apart.
"Who the hell are you?"
she bellowed. And for a moment that age-weakened voice rose to something like its old power. She rose from her seat, fists clenched.
"How did you get up here?"
"We are your servants, my Lady Vorcenza. Your servants come to pay you our proper respects at last. You must forgive us our previous discourtesy. Things have been so busy of late in my little kingdom.
You speak as though I should know you, sir. I ask your name.
I have several, said the older man, but now I am called Caparaza. This is my associate, who styles himself the Falconer, and as for now, we came to your truly lovely solarium.
He gestured to the Falconer, who held up his left hand, palm spread toward Doña Vorcenza. The coat sleeve fell away, revealing three thick black lines tattooed at his wrist.
"Gods," Vorcenza whispered, "a bondsmage."
"Indeed," said Caparaza, "for which forgive me, but his art seemed the only way to ensure that your servants would haul us up here, and the only way to ensure that we could enter your sanctum without disturbing you beforehand."
"I am disturbed now," she spat. "What is your meaning here?"
"It is past time," said Raza, "for my associate and I to have a conversation with the Duke's spider."
"What are you speaking of? This is my tower. Other than my servants, there is no one else here."
"True," said Caparaza. "So there is no need to maintain your little fiction before us, my lady."
"You," said Doña Vorcenza coldly and levelly, "are greatly mistaken."
"Those files behind you, what are they? Recipes? Those notes beside your chair? Does Stephen Reynard give you regular reports on the cuts and colors of this year's new dresses, fresh off the docks? Come, my lady, I have very unusual means of gathering information, and I am no dullard. I would construe any further dissembling on your part as a deliberate insult."
"I regard your uninvited presence here," said Doña Vorcenza after a moment of consideration, "as nothing less."
"I have displeased you," said Raza, "and for that I apologize. But have you any means to back that displeasure with force? Your servants sleep peacefully. Your Reynard and all of your midnighters are elsewhere, prying into my affairs. You are alone with us, Doña Vorcenza, so why not speak civilly? I have come to be civil and to speak in earnest."
She stared coldly at him for several moments, and then waved a hand at one of the solarium's armchairs.
"Have a seat, Master Revenge. I fear there's no comfortable chair for your associate."
"It will be well," said the Falconer. "I'm very fond of writing desks."
He settled himself behind the little desk near the door, while Raza crossed the room and sat down opposite Doña Vorcenza.
Revenge indeed. And have you had it?"
"I have," said Caparaza cheerfully. "I find it's everything it's been made out to be."
"You bore Capa Barsavi some grudge?"
"Ha! Some grudge, yes. It could be said that's why I had his sons murdered while he watched, and then fed him to the sharks he so loved."
"Old business between the two of you?"
"I have dreamed of Vencarlo Barsavi's ruin for 20 years. "'Said Raza. "'And now I've brought it about, and I've replaced him. "'I'm sorry if this affair has been an inconvenience for you, "'but that is all that I am sorry for.'
"'Barsavi was not a kind man,' said Vorcenza. "'He was a ruthless criminal, but he was perceptive. "'He understood many things the lesser Cappers did not.' The arrangement I made with him bore fruit on both sides.
"And it would be a shame to lose it," said Raza. "I admire the secret peace very much, Doña Vorcenza. My admiration for it is quite distinct from my loathing for Barsavi. I should like to see the arrangement continued in full. I gave orders to that effect on the very night I took Barsavi's place." "So my agents tell me," said Doña Vorcenza. "But I must confess I had hoped to hear it in your own words before now."
"My delay was unavoidable," said Raza. "But there we are. I have terrible manners, to which I readily admit. Allow me to make it up to you."
"How so?"
"I should greatly enjoy a chance to attend the Duke's Day of Changes feast. I am capable of dressing and acting rather well. I could be introduced as a gentleman of independent means. I assure you, no one in Raven's Reach would recognize me. I gazed up at these towers as a boy in Camor. I should like to pay my proper respects to the peers of Camor just once. I would not come without gifts. I have something rather lavish in mind."
"That," said Doña Vorcenza slowly, "may be too much to ask. Our worlds, Caparaza, are not meant to meet. I do not come to your thieves' revels."
"Yet your agents do," he said cheerfully.
"No longer. Tell me, why did you order them exiled? The penalty for turncoating among your people is death, so why didn't they merit a knife across the throat?"
"Would you really prefer them dead, Doña Vorcenza?"
"Hardly, but I am curious about your motives."
"I, for my part, thought they were transparent. I need to have a measure of security. I simply cannot leave your agents lying about underfoot as Barsavi did. Of course, I didn't want to antagonize you more than necessary, so I presumed letting them live would be a friendly gesture." "Doña Vorcenza," said Raza, "I have every confidence that you will begin the work of inserting new agents into the ranks of my people almost immediately. I welcome it. May the most subtle planner win. But we have set aside the main point of this conversation."
"Caparaza," said the Doña, "you do not seem to be a man who needs sentiments wrapped in delicacy to salve his feelings. So let me be plain. It is one thing entirely for the two of us to have a working relationship, to preserve the secret peace for the good of all Camor. I am even content to meet with you here, if I must, assuming you are properly invited and escorted. But I simply cannot bring a man of your station into the Duke's presence."
"That is disappointing," said Caparaza. "Yet he can have Giancana Maraggio as a guest, can he not? A man who utilized my predecessor's services on many occasions, and many other captains of shipping and finance who profited from arrangements with Barsavi's gangs. The secret peace enriches every peer of Camor. I am, in effect, their servant. My forbearance keeps money in their pockets. Am I truly so base a creature that I cannot stand by the refreshment tables a while and merely enjoy the sights of the affair? Wander the sky garden and satisfy my curiosity?"
"Caparaza," said Doña Vorcenza, "you are plucking at strings of conscience that will yield no sound. I am not the Duke's spider because I have a soft heart. I mean you no insult, truly, but let me frame it in these terms. You have been Capa now for barely 1 week. I have only begun to form my opinion of you. You remain a stranger, sir. If you rule a year from now, and you maintain stability among the right people, and preserve the secret peace, well then, perhaps some consideration could be given to what you propose."
"And that is how it must be?"
"That is how it must be, for now."
"Alas," said Caparaza, "this refusal pains me more than you could know. I have gifts that I simply cannot wait until next year to reveal to all the peers of this fair city. I must, with all apologies, refuse your refusal."
"What on earth do you mean?"
Falconer.
The bondsmaid stood up at Doña Vorcenza's writing desk. He'd taken a quill in his hands and set one of her sheets of parchment out before him.
Doña Vorcenza, he said as he wrote in a bold, looping script. Angiovesta Vorcenza, is it not? What a lovely name. What a very lovely, very true name.
In his left hand the silver thread wove back and forth. His fingers flew, and on the page a strange silver-blue glow began to arise. Angiovesta Vorcenza was outlined in that fire, and across the room the Doña moaned and clutched her head.
I am sorry to press my case by less than amiable means, Doña Vorcenza, said Caparaza, but can you not see that it would be to the Duke's very great advantage to have me as his guest? Surely you would not want to deny him those gifts which I would place at his feet with all due respect.
I cannot say. Yes, said the falconer. Oh, yes, you would be very pleased to accept this idea, to ensure that Caparaza was invited to the Day of Change's feast in the most cordial spirit of good fellowship.
The words on the parchment in his hands glowed more brightly.
Caparaza, said Doña Vorcenza slowly, you must, of course, accept the Duke's hospitality. You will not be denied, said the falconer. Caparaza must agree to accept your invitation. You simply will not settle for a refusal. I will not take no for an answer.
And I will not give it, said Raza. You are most kind, Doña Vorcenza, most kind. And my gifts? I have four exquisite sculptures I should like to give to the Duke. I have no need to intrude on his affairs. My men can simply leave them somewhere at the feast with your cooperation. We can bring them to his attention when he is less pressed for time.
How lovely, said the falconer. You are very fond of this suggestion. Nothing would please me more, Caparaza. Very proper of you.
Yes, said Caparaza. It is very proper of me. It is only just.
He chuckled, then rose from his seat and waved to the falconer.
Doña Vorcenza, said the bondsmaid, this conversation has pleased you greatly. You will look forward to seeing Caparaza at the Day of Changes, and to lending him every assistance in bringing his important gifts into Raven's Reach.
He folded the parchment and slipped it into a waistcoat pocket, then made a few more gestures with his silver thread. Doña Vorcenza blinked several times and breathed deeply.
Caparaza, she said, must you really go? It has made for a pleasant diversion speaking to you this evening.
And I, for my part, have found you the most charming of hostesses, my Lady Vorcenza.
He bowed from the waist, right foot forward in perfect courtly fashion.
But business is pressing everywhere. I must be about mine and leave you to yours.
So be it, dear boy.
She began to rise, and he gestured for her to stay seated.
No, no, don't trouble yourself on our account. We can find our way back down your lovely tower on our own. Pray return to whatever you were doing before I interrupted.
It was hardly an interruption, said Doña Vorcenza. I shall see you then on the Day of Changes. You will accept the invitation?
Yes, said Caparaza.
He turned and favored her with a smile before he stepped out through the solarium door.
I gladly accept your invitation, and I shall see you on the Day of Changes at Raven's Reach.
Interlude. The Daughters of Camor. The first true revolution in Camor's criminal affairs came long before Kappa Barsavi. It predated his rise by nearly 50 years, in fact, and it came about entirely as the result of a certain lack of self-control on the part of a pimp called Rude Trevor Vargas. Rude Trevor had a great many other nicknames, most of them used privately in his little stable of whores. To say that he was an intemperate, murderous lunatic would wound the feelings of most intemperate, murderous lunatics. As was often the case, he was a greater danger to his own whores than the marks they plied for coppers and silvers. The only protection he really offered them was protection from his own fists, which could be had by giving him all but a tiny fraction of the money they worked for. One night, a particularly put-upon whore found herself unwilling to participate in his preferred evening diversion, which was to take his pleasure from her mouth while pulling on her hair until she screamed in pain. Her bodice dagger was out before she realized it. She planted it just to the left of Trevor's manhood, in the joint of his thigh, and slashed to his right. There was an awful lot of blood, not to mention screaming, but Trevor's attempts to first fight back and then to flee were greatly hampered by the speed with which his life was gushing out between his legs. His former whore pulled him to the ground and sat on his back to keep him from crawling out of the room. His strength ebbed, and he died in very short order, mourned by exactly no one. The next night, Trevor's kappa sent another man around to take over Trevor's duties. The women in Trevor's old stable welcomed him with smiling faces and offered him a chance to try out their services for free. Because he had a small pile of broken bricks where most people kept their brains, he accepted. When he was neatly undressed and separated from his weapons, he was stabbed to death from several directions at once. That really caught the attention of Trevor's old kappa. The next night, he sent 5 or 6 men to straighten the situation out. But a curious thing had happened. Another 2 or 3 packs of whores had gotten rid of their pimps. A growing nucleus of women claimed a warehouse in the Northern Snare as their headquarters. The Carper's men found not 6 or 7 frightened whores, as they'd been told, but nearly 2 dozen angry women, who'd seen fit to arm themselves using all the coin they could muster. Crossbows are quite an equalizer, especially at close range, with the advantage of surprise. Those 5 or 6 men were never seen again. So the war began in earnest. Those coppers who had lost pimps and whores attempted to correct the situation, while with every passing day the number of women joining the rebellion grew. They hired several other gangs to serve as their own protection. They established houses of pleasure to their own standards, and began to work out of them. The service they offered, in comfortable and well-appointed chambers, was greatly superior to that which could be had from the gangs of whores still run by men, and prospective customers began to weigh in with their coin on the side of the ladies. There was a great deal of blood. Dozens of whores were brutally murdered, and several of their bordellos were burnt to the ground. But for every lady of the night that fell, some kappa's man would get the same. The ladies gave like for like as viciously as any kappa in Camor's history. Less than a year after Rude Trevor's death, the last few pimps clinging brutally to their livelihood were convinced to death in most cases, to give up their fight. An uneasy truce fell into place between the kappas and the city's whores. Eventually, this truce grew into a stable and mutually beneficial arrangement. The whores of the city split amiably into 2 groups, defined by territory. The Doxies took the west side of Camor, while the Gilded Lilies ruled in the east. And both organizations mingled comfortably in the Snare, where business was most plentiful. They continued to prosper. They hired loyal muscle of their own and ceased renting cutthroats from other gangs. While their lives could not be deemed pleasant, in light of their trade, at least they were now firmly in control of their own affairs, and free to enforce certain rules of decorum on their customers. They built and preserved a monopoly, and in exchange for promising not to become involved in any other forms of crime, they secured the right to mercilessly crush any attempt to pimp women outside the purview of their 2 gangs. Naturally, some men didn't pay close attention to the rules the women set. They attempted to slap their whores around, or renege on their payments for services, or ignore the standards the ladies set concerning cleanliness and drunkenness. Hard lessons were handed out. As many men learned to their sorrow, it's impossible to be intimidating when one angry woman has your cock between her teeth and another is holding a stiletto to your kidneys. When Vencarlo Barsavi slew his opponents and rose to prominence as the sole Kappa of Camor, even he dared not disturb the equilibrium that had grown between the traditional gangs and the two guilds of whores. He met with representatives from the Doxies and the Lilies. He agreed to let them preserve their quasi-autonomous status, and they agreed to regular payments for his assistance, payments as a percentage of profits, significantly lower than any other dues paid to the Kappa by the right people of Camor. Barsavi realized something that too many men in the city were slow to grasp, an idea that he reinforced years later when he took the Barangius sisters to be his primary enforcers. He was wise enough to understand that the women of Camor could be underestimated only at great peril to one's health. Chapter 15. Spider Bite. 1.
"Can you assure me," said Ibelius, "that you will take better care of yourself than you did previously, or that your friend Jean has taken for himself this past week?"
"Master Ibelius," said Locke, "you are our physica, not our mother. And as I have already told you a dozen times this afternoon, I am entirely prepared, body and mind, for this affair at Raven's Reach. I am the soul of caution."
"La, sir, if that is the case, I should hope never to meet the soul of recklessness."
"Ibelius," groaned Jean, "let him alone. You are henpecking him without having the decency to marry him first." Jean sat upon the sleeping pallet, haggard and rather scruffy. The darkness of the hairs thickening on his face only emphasized his own unnatural pallor. His injuries had been a close thing. A great wad of cloth was tied around his naked chest, and similar bandages wrapped his leg beneath his breeches and his upper right arm. "These physicas are handy things," said Locke, adjusting his, formerly Moraggio's, coat cuffs, "but I think next time we should pay a bit extra for the silent version, Jean."
"And then you may dress your own wounds, sir, and apply your own poultices. Though I dare say it would be quicker and easier for the pair of you to simply dig your own graves and take your ease in them until your inevitable transition to a more quiet state of affairs."
"Master Ibelius," said Locke, grasping the old man by the arms, "Jean and I are more grateful than we can say for your aid. I suspect that we would both be dead without your intervention. I mean to repay you for the time you've endured with us here in this hovel. I expect to come into a few thousand crowns in very short order. Some of it is yours. You shall have a new life far from here with very full pockets, and the rest will be used to put Kappa Raza under the earth. Take heart. Look what Jean has already done to his sisters." "A feat I'm in no condition to perform again," said Jean. "Take care of yourself, Locke. I won't be able to come running to the rescue if something goes awry tonight."
"Though I have no doubt you would try," muttered Ibelius.
"Don't worry, Jean. It'll be nothing but a routine evening with the Duke and his entire fucking court, assembled in a glass tower 600 feet in the air. What could possibly go wrong?" "That sarcasm sounds half-hearted," said Jean. "You're really looking forward to this, aren't you?" "Of course I am, Jean. Chains would be beside himself with glee if he were alive. I'm going to play Lucas Fairwhite in front of the God's damned Duke, not to mention all the other peers of our acquaintance, the Damars, the Falluccias, old Javaris. Glory to the crooked warden, it's going to be fantastic fucking fun, assuming I'm on top of my game. And then money in our pockets. And then revenge." "When are you expected at the Salvara Manor?" "Third hour of the afternoon, which means I've no more time to dawdle. Jean, Ibelius, how do I look?"
"I would hardly recognize the man we laid on that sick bed not so many days ago," said Ibelius. "I'll confess, you've a surprising degree of professional skill. I'd never conceived of such a thing as this false facing of yours."
"'That's to our advantage, Master Rebellious,' said Jean. "'Very few have. "'You look ready for the evening, Master Fairwhite. "'Now, you're going to take the long way round to the Isla Durona, right?' "'Gods, yes. "'I'm only mad to a certain measure. "'I'll go north through the graveyards and up through the quiet. "'I expect I won't see a soul once I'm out of Ashfall.' As he spoke, he draped himself with the oilcloak Jean had brought back from his encounter with the Barangia sisters, despite the sweltering heat. It would conceal his fine garments from sight until he reached the Hill of Whispers. A man dressed in evening best might attract too much attention from some of the lurkers in the dark places of Ashfall. "'I'm for Raven's Reach, then,' said Locke. "'Until much later, Jean. Rest up. Master Rebellious!' Favour Jean with your motherly attention. I hope to return with very good news.
I shall be grateful if you return at all, said Ibelius.
2. Midsummer Mark, the day of changes, the 17th of Parthis in the 78th year of Azaguia, as the Therin calendar would have it. On the day of changes, the city of Camor went mad. A shifting revel commanded the wide circular pond of the market, but this one was smaller and more ragged than the formal monthly revels. The centerpiece of this one was a floating handball court made from a number of flat-topped barges lashed together. Teams of commoners had selected colours from out of a barrel. Now randomly matched, they were mauling one another drunkenly as a crowd composed entirely of commoners cheered. When a team scored, a small boat with a beer keg lashed amidships would pull alongside the playing court and ladle out a drink for every man on that team. Naturally, the matches got wilder and dirtier as they progressed. Quite a few players were flung into the water, there to be fished out by a crew of diligent yellow jackets who wouldn't otherwise dream of interfering. Commoners ruled the streets of Lower Camor on the day of changes. They held wandering picnics, hauling ale barrels and wine bags around with them. Streams of celebrants would cross paths, jostle, join, and split. A god's-eye view of the affair would have shown disorderly men and women circulating through the city streets like blood through the vessels of an inebriated man. In the snare, business was bountiful. The celebration sucked in sailors and visitors from foreign shores like a tidal pool drawing downward. A few hours of Camorri hospitality, and the guest revellers were unlikely to be able to tell their asses from their eardrums. There would be few ships setting out from port the next day. Few would have the able manpower necessary to raise so much as a flag pennant, let alone a sail. In the cauldron and the narrows and the dregs, Capa Raza's people celebrated their new ruler's largesse. By his order, dozens upon dozens of casks of cheap red wine had been rolled out in dog carts. Those gangs that were too poor or too lazy to journey to the crossroads of wickedness that was the snare drank themselves silly on their own doorsteps. Raza's garistas passed through the neighbourhoods he claimed as his own with baskets of bread, passing them out to anyone who asked for them. It turned out that each loaf had either a copper piece or a silver piece baked into it, and when these hidden gifts were revealed, by means of a few unlucky broken teeth, not a single loaf of bread was safe from depredation south of the temple district. Raza's floating grave was open for visitors. Several of his garistas and their gangs amused themselves with a game of cards that grew to epic size. At its height, 45 men and women were bickering and shuffling and drinking and screaming at one another on the floor above the dark waters of the waste, the waters that had eaten Capa Barsavi and his entire family. Raza was nowhere to be seen. Raza had business in the north that evening, and he told none outside his close circle of original servants that he would be at the Duke's court, looking down on them from the tower of Raven's Reach. In the temple district, the day of changes was celebrated in a more restrained fashion. Each temple's full complement of priests and initiates traded places with another in an ever-shifting cycle. The black robes of Azaguia's house conducted a stately ritual on the steps of Iono's temple. The servants of the Father of Grasping Waters did likewise at theirs. Dama Elisa and Azri, Morganti and Nara, Gandalo and Sendavani,
All the delegations of the divine burned candles and sang to the sky before a different altar, then moved on a few minutes later. A few extra benedictions were offered at the burnt-out house of Perelandro, where a single old man in the white robes of the Lord of the Overlooked, recently summoned from Ashmir, pondered the mess of a temple that had been thrust into his care. He had no idea how to begin composing his report to the chief divine of Perelandro on the destruction he'd found in an elderglass cellar, the existence of which he'd not been informed of before his journey. In the north corner and Fountain Bend, well-to-do young couples made for 2 silver green, where it was thought to be good luck to make love on the eve of the Midsummer Mark. It was said that any union consummated there before false light would bring the couple whatever they most desired in a child. This was a pleasant bonus, if true, but for the time being most of the men and women hidden away among the crushed stone paths and rustling walls of greenery desired only one another. On the waters of Old Harbour, the frigate Satisfaction floated at anchor, yellow flags flying atop its masts, yellow lanterns shining even by day. A dozen figures moved on its deck, surreptitiously going about the business of preparing the ship for night action. Crossbows were racked at the masts, and canvas tarps flung over them. Anti-boarding nets were hauled out below the rails on the ship's upper deck and set there for rapid rigging, out of sight. Buckets of sand were set out to smother flames. If the shore engines let fly, some of them would surely hurl alchemical fire, against which water would be worse than useless. In the darkened holds beneath the ship's upper deck, another 3 dozen men and women ate a large meal, to have their stomachs full when the time for action came. There wasn't an invalid among them, not so much as an ague fever. At the foot of Raven's Reach, home and palace of Duke Nicovante of Camor, 100 carriages were parked in a spiralling fashion around the tower's base. 400 liveried drivers and guards milled about, enjoying refreshments brought to them by scampering men and women in the Duke's colours. They would be there waiting all night for the descent of their lords and ladies. The Day of Changes was the only day of the year when nearly every peer of Camor, every lesser noble from the Alchigrante Islands and every last member of the 5 families in their glass towers would be crammed together in one place, to drink and feast and scheme and intrigue and offer compliments and insults, while the Duke gazed down on them with his rheumy eyes. Each year the coming generation of Camor's rulers watched the old guard grey a bit more before their eyes. Each year their bows and curtsies grew slightly more exaggerated. Each year the whispers behind their hands grew more poisonous. Nicovante had, perhaps, ruled too long. There were 6 chain elevators serving Raven's Reach. They rose and fell, rose and fell. With each new cage that creaked open at the top of the tower, a new flurry of people in coloured coats and elaborate dresses was disgorged onto the embarkation terrace to mingle with the chattering flood of nobles and flatterers, power brokers and pretenders, merchants and idlers and drunkards and courtly predators. The sun beat down on this gathering with all of its power. The lords and ladies of Camor seemed to be standing on a lake of molten silver at the top of a pillar of white fire. The air rippled with waves of heat as the iron cage holding Loch Lamora and the Salvaras swung clattering into the locking mechanisms at the edge of the Duke's terrace. 3.
"Holy Marrows," said Locke. "But I have never seen the like. I have never been this high in the air. By the hands beneath the waters, I have never been this high in society. My lord and Lady Salvara, pardon me if I cling to you both like a drowning man."
"Sophia and I have been coming here since we were children," said Lorenzo, "every year on this day. It's only overwhelming the first 10 or 11 times you see it, believe me."
"I shall have to take you at your word, my lord."
Attendants in black and silver livery, with rows of polished silver buttons gleaming in the sunlight, held the cage door open for them as Locke followed the Salvaras onto the embarkation terrace. A squad of black jackets marched past, in full ceremonial dress, with rapiers carried over their shoulders in silver-chased scabbards. The soldiers wore tall black fur hats with medallions bearing the crest of the Duchy of Camor just above their eyes. Locke winced to think at how those must have felt, marching back and forth beneath the sun's merciless consideration for hours on end. His own clothes were working up a healthy sweat, but he and his hosts had the option of moving inside the tower at will.
"Don Lorenzo and Doña Sofia, my lord and Lady Salvara?"
The man who approached them from the edge of the crowd was very tall and wide-shouldered. He stood a full head above most of the Camorri present, and his angular features and singularly fair hair were the mark of the oldest, purest sort of Vadran blood. This man had roots in the far northeast, in Astrath or Vintilla, the heartlands of the Kingdom of the Seven Marrows. Curiously, he was dressed in night-glass company black, with a captain's silver collar pips, and his voice was pure upper-class Camor, without the hint of any other accent.
"Why, yes," said Don Lorenzo. "Your servant, my lord and lady. My name is Stephen Reynard. Doña Vorcenza, I believe, should have mentioned me to you."
"Oh, of course." Doña Sofia held out her hand. Reynard bent at the waist with his right foot forward, took her hand and kissed the air just above it. "So pleased to make your acquaintance at last, Captain Reynard. And how is dear Doña Vorcenza this afternoon?"
"She is knitting, my lady," said Reynard with a smirk that told of some private joke. "She has commandeered one of the Duke's sitting-rooms for herself. You know how she feels about large, noisy gatherings."
"I must, of course, find her," said Sophia. "I should love to see her."
"I'm sure the feeling will be mutual, my lady. But may I presume? Is this Master Fairwhite, the merchant of Emberlane, I was told you would be bringing?"
Reynard bowed again, just the neck this time, and in heavily accented Vadran he said,
"May the marrows run sweet and the seas run calm, Master Fairwhite."
"May the hands beneath the waves carry you to good fortune," Locke replied in his own much smoother Vadran, genuinely surprised. He switched back to Therin for the sake of politeness.
"One of my countrymen, Captain Reynard? In the service of the Duke of Camor? How fascinating!"
"I am most definitely of the Vadran blood," said Reynard, "but my parents died when I was an infant on a trading mission to this city. I was adopted and raised by Doña Vorcenza, the Countess of Amberglass, the bright golden tower over there. She had no children of her own. Although I cannot inherit her title and her properties, I have been allowed to serve in the Duke's night-class company."
"Astonishing! I must say you look exceedingly formidable. The image of the kings of the Marrows themselves. I'd wager the Duke is only too pleased to have you in his service."
"I hope with all my heart for that to be true, Master Fairwhite. But come, I'm holding you up. I beg pardon, my lord and Lady Salvara, I am hardly a worthy topic of conversation. Let me show you into the tower, by your leave."
"By all means," said Sophia. She leaned close to Locke's ear and whispered, "Doña Vorcenza is a dear old thing, something like a grandmother to all of us Alcigrante ladies. She is the arbiter of all our gossip, you might say. She's not well. She's more and more distant with every passing month, but she is still very close to us. I hope you will have the chance to make her acquaintance."
"I shall look forward to it, my Lady Salvara."
Reynard ushered them into the Tower of Raven's Reach itself, and the sight that met Locke's eyes drew an unwilling gasp from his mouth. From the outside, Raven's Reach was opaque silver. From the inside, at least on the levels he could see, it was nearly transparent. A smoky haze seemed to live within the glass, cutting out the glare of the sun, reducing it to a plain white circle overhead that the naked eye could easily bear to regard. But in all other ways it let in the view as though it were not there at all. The hilly countryside and the wide Angevine lay to the north, while all the islands of the lower city lay spread like illustrations on a map to the south. Locke could even make out the thin black shapes of ships' masts bobbing past the southern edge of the city. his stomach fluttered with the thrill of vertigo. On the level of the tower just above them, the sky garden began. There were said to be 100 tons of rich earth in the pots and troughs atop